and deserves a tremendous amount of credit for his work in publishing GI Special, and who's one of the founding members of the Military Project. He reports that there's been an upturn in mail to GI Special and soldiers willing to be quoted against the war. One example of that is the sergeant in the April 24th Army Times, who in a letter said, quote, "After spending a year in Iraq, I have found that the Iraqis are not a threat or the enemy. We do not know what we are fighting for anymore. We don't know what our mission is. The Iraqis acted as we would if someone came into America and said, we are going to change your ways." Of course, that wouldn't be such a bad thing in a lot of ways, but I think you take the point. "I feel this war is no longer about taking out a threat, but I believe it's about securing oil commerce for the future." That's one example. Another example is a quote from the February 28th, 06 ZOGBI poll, which found that 72% of US troops said that the United States should get out of Iraq by the end of this year. And an amazing 29% were for immediate withdrawal. But that opinion, which is against the war within the ranks of the military, is now turning into action, which leads us to the next three people who are going to introduce to you some of what if that action is. And so first I'd like to introduce Todd Ensign from Citizen Soldier, again, someone who needs no introduction. And who will report on the first coffee house project, which is being established by Citizen Soldier at Fort Drum in upstate New York. Todd.
Thank you. I will try to keep to my five-minute limit. As you can imagine, these subject like this could be, we could sit here and talk about it for a long time. I want to just bring one thing to your attention in case some of you don't know about this book, Soldiers in Revolt. It was out of print for about 30 years, and just 2 years ago, the Haymarket Press did a real public service by republishing it. And this book, even to those of us who remember that war very well, this book will surprise you, because it tells a story of a movement that just mushroomed. And that sort of brings me to the point about Different Drummer. We decided to open a project at Fort Drum. This is a base which a lot of older people in New York actually associate only with reserve training, and that's accurate. But about 20 years ago, actually 22 years ago, the decision was made to create a new type of division, or transfer a division to that base, and then retrain it. And that, hence the name, it's called the 10th Mountain Light. Light in brackets, kind of, but it doesn't mean like Bud Light. It's a different kind of light. And you can, you know, you don't have to know a lot about military strategy to realize that what they mean is a type of division that can deploy anywhere in the world, 72-86 hours flaps up. That's the concept. And so it's light on the armor, light on the air support, but it's very highly trained in the counterinsurgency wars, which they see as the future. And it actually happens to be one of Rummy's favorite divisions. And it's growing. It's continuing to add troops. They're up to about 13,000 combat troops up there. The other reason we liked it was it's all combat. It's not an administrative basis. No computer guys there. Pretty much all soldiers. And that means that by now, most of these people have done two tours already. And one of our goals in the next months, and some of you have seen this on the internet, the 172nd Striker Brigade out of Alaska, out of Fort Wainwright, Alaska. And that's the brigade that was supposed to come home in September. Remember, they did their year. Guys are crossing out the days on the calendar. Comes to September, and Rummy says, nope, not so fast. And in fact, 300 of them had actually redeployed to Alaska. And Rummy said, nope, they're all staying another 4 months. Well, this has ignited a protest within the unit, within the support elements to the unit, which you can see on the internet at bringhome 172ndStrikerBrigade.org. And some good-hearted citizen has created this site, and there are dozens of has a blog with it, and there's dozens and dozens of entries by people. That's the sort of thing that we would hope to see to evolve at Fort Drum. The reason for that is that in March, the 3rd Brigade is coming home from Iraq. That's about 4,200 combat troops. Those who haven't been injured or killed, of course, are coming home. And we know that within months, of course, if the war continues, which I can't see why it won't, unless we can make some other major changes. I mean, it's not going to change because Nancy Pelosi, Speaker of the House, I guess that's what I want to say. And everyone in this room certainly knows that. And hopefully we can build within that community the trust, the kind of links that it takes. And I'll be candid with you. We've been open 3 weeks. We're getting some soldiers in on weekends. We have rock and roll bands. We have a DJ. We're going to start a talent night soon. We're going to have rap and comedy and all kinds of things like that. And any of you, certainly, if you're in the area, it is a little remote. It's 60 miles north of Syracuse, but it's actually a beautiful countryside up there. And our website is www.differentdrummercafe. Be sure and put the cafe in, because if you just put differentdrummer.org, you might be a little... Well, I'll leave it at that, but put differentdrummercafe.org, and you will see what's going on up there every week. You're more than welcome, of course, to visit. So, to conclude, we're at the opening stage of this. We're building links. We're trying to build the confidence and trust of soldiers. Anyone that's, you guys out there, that's done this work knows that's a slow process, but we're offering legal help, counseling, and I hope that with the return of the 3rd Brigade, we're going to start to really see whether we can affect as a unit-wide the kind of consciousness and attitudes which many individual soldiers, as Mike said, have already expressed. And if we can begin to do that, believe me, we will begin to reach a point, which is about halfway into this book, when the military basically could no longer be sure that its orders in the field would be executed. And their combat refusals, there's a famous essay worth reading sometime by a man named Colonel Robert Heinel, H-E-I-N-L. Some of you are shaking your heads. This essay was called The Death of the Army, and it was written in 1971. And of course, you can imagine his point of view was this was a terrible thing. This was an absolute outrageous scandal. And what we went to Vietnam, and he basically documented the desertions, combat refusals, the fraggings in some cases, just the general level of resistance which bubbled up throughout that military there. And that's the sort of process that is so well described in this book. I'm not going to stand here in front of you and tell you that is what will occur again. We're talking about an all-volunteer force. We're talking about a force that's one-third the size of the Vietnam active military. That makes a big difference. Much more pressure is put on people. We're talking about a military that's willing to pay people tens of thousands of dollars in bonuses. Nothing but blood money, really. And people need it, and they take it to try to, you know, advance their own lives. So that's the kind of military we're dealing with. We've got to struggle with that, and I hope that in 6 months I can come back to you. We're going to have it at the Left Forum this spring. We're going to have a retrospective about it. I hope I can come back and tell you that we've been able to make some success. Finally, we want this to grow as an idea, to see other projects around the country bubble up and emerge. And if we can do that along with this project, we will have accomplished a lot. Thank you.
Before our next speaker, I neglected to read a brief letter which Tom had asked me to read that has just recently, in fact today, come into GI Special that he thought was worth sharing with everyone here. It's dated today, and it states the following. I am a Vietnam vet who has spent his 55th birthday in Ramadi and will be spending my 56th in Balad in a week. I feel I have a unique slant on this war. When people say, quote, it's just like Vietnam, I have to chuckle. Apart from the fact that the politicians have involved the military in a conflict that is micromanaged to the point of being unwinnable, it is nothing like Vietnam. I am looking at it from the point of the everyday soldier and his daily life. It seems they are so intent on making it so much like home, what with the Burger King, Taco Bell, Pizza Hut, and Subway. The cable TV and internet service are just ways to desensitize to what is actually happening here. Everyone here and in the States have their knickers in a knot over a casualty count of less than 1,000 a year, but you hear nothing of the 6,000 plus 14 to 19 year olds who die in motor vehicle accidents every year. I may be jaded, but I'm suspicious of the true concern over loss of valued youth that comes out of the mouths on both sides of the issue. The true crime here is what we have done to the people of Iraq. Not that I think that Saddam was great for them by any means, but from what I have seen over the last year is we could not have fucked it up any worse than we have if we had tried. What I fear the most is the way the American public is willing to give up so many civil liberties for such a cheap price. I mean, a few thousand lives and a false sense of security is a shameful price to surrender habeas corpus. The founding fathers are turning over in their graves. I guess I'll get off my soapbox now. I hope that our country will survive this mess in spite of ourselves. Thanks for the chance to vent. Sergeant, Staff Sergeant, whose initials are given, Balad Iraq. It's interesting to note, of course, that this is a non-com who's writing this. This isn't even just a regular grunt. This is somebody who's a supervisor, essentially, in that situation. He's obviously come to that conclusion. So with that, I will introduce to you Fabien Bouthillette, to my left, who is a member of the U.S. Navy Reserve, of Iraq Veterans Against the War, and a veteran of the Iraq War. Fabien.
Well, good evening, and thanks for coming out. I am the understudy for this portion, so forgive me, it's not as smooth as it was supposed to be. But what I have here is an appeal for redress from the war in Iraq. And this was started internally. Specifically, this appeal was made by an active duty Marine in Quantico, Virginia, and active duty sailor in Norfolk, Virginia. I'll just read it for you. It states, "As a patriotic American, proud to serve the nation in uniform, I respectfully urge my political leaders in Congress to support the prompt withdrawal of all American military forces and bases from Iraq. Staying in Iraq will not work and is not worth the price. It is time for U.S. troops to come home." And there are four bullets under the nature of the grievance. So specifically, the fabricated justification for war. Of course, back in 2003 when I was a first-class midshipman or senior at the Naval Academy, we were being told day in and day out that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And if we didn't go in and take them out, we were going to be attacked by Iraq. So, of course, everyone had it in their head, well, we better go to Iraq and take them out and their weapons of mass destruction or we're all going to get killed. And, of course, that has turned out to be a complete lie, and all of us, well, the 1,000 signers of this appeal so far, feel, I think, betrayal is the proper word to use. I know I absolutely feel betrayed by our government. My trust in them that there were weapons there was betrayed. So that's bullet one of the grievance. Second bullet, the failure to provide troops adequate protection and preparation for combat. Armor on Humvees, personal body protection. I'm sure most of you in here have heard about those stories. And of course, National Guard units being sent over there that aren't really properly trained for this mission. And our Army in general, not really trained for this type of mission going on. Third bullet, human cost and thousands of deaths and severe injuries among American service members. And fourth, the economic cost to American taxpayers and diversion of resources from other priorities. I mean, we could all name a million things that we could be spending our time and money on. Specifically listed on the appeal is inadequate response to Hurricane Katrina, but that's not the only example, of course. This appeal will be on the back on the military project table. And I just want to point out that it is only for active duty or reservists to sign. If you know someone that is active duty or reservist not here tonight, please take one. Please spread the word. Tell them that this exists. So far, we've got 1,000 people, and I think that's pretty significant that this has started internally within the active duty of the armed services. So please, if you're haven't signed it yet, please take a look at it. And if you know someone that would sign this, take a copy and send it to them. So thank you.
And now I'd like to introduce to my left Elaine Brower, who's going to be speaking for the Military Project tonight.
Good evening and welcome, everyone. I'm Elaine Brower, and I'm a member of the Military Project. I'm also a member of MFSO and World Can't Wait, and I'm a citizen of the United States of America. I'm going to read to you tonight a petition for redress of grievances that was also developed and written by active duty National Guards. And we at the Military Project have worked with them. We've put this together, and we hand it out to, in our outreach sessions, to the National Guard at the Armory. I'd just like to tell you a little bit about myself. My son just returned from Iraq. He was in Fallujah for almost a year. So before that, he was in Afghanistan, and I got very active. And one of the things I did in searching amongst various organizations was I kept saying, you know, we really need to reach out to the military. There's got to be guys in the military that don't want to be there, that know this war is illegal and immoral. Because I heard my son, and he wasn't happy about being there, but he did it out of duty to his country and for his buddies. So I kept going to military bases by myself or with one or two other brave people that would come with me and hand out flyers and talk to military personnel, and they were very receptive. Then a friend of mine on Staten Island where I live said, you know, there's a guy, Tom Barton, who writes GI Special. You should contact him. Maybe, you know, they'll be doing something along those lines. And here I am tonight, and I love working with the Military Project. It definitely is where we want to be. The anti-war movement is one thing, but resistance from within is very important. And if we reach out to those members of the military that are resisting, then we can bridge that gap and bring them home now. This is a petition for redress of grievances. We, the undersigned members of the National Guard and Reserves of the Armed Forces of the United States of America, do now lawfully petition Congress for redress of our grievances. We call on the Congress of the United States to ensure that when any member of the National Guard or Reserves is called to active duty and their employer cuts off their pay and they are forced to subsist only on the pay received from the armed forces, that Congress, acting on behalf of the people, shall make financially whole those called to active duty, and they and their families shall suffer no decrease in income, and their present sufferings in that regard shall end forthwith. There's the cause here, and then I'll read you the effect. Harsh eligibility rules cut most Guard and Reserve members out of financial help. This was in the Army Times in August. Some reservists called up for lengthy or repeated mobilizations could get extra pay under the new Defense Department program that kicks in this month, but the eligibility rules are narrowly written and the program is not retroactive. Under those constraints, defense officials estimate the program will apply to only about 2,000 people in its current configuration. Eligibility for the Reserve Income Replacement Program is complicated. To qualify, Guard and Reserve members must be on involuntary active duty and must have completed at least 18 months of continuous involuntary active service, completed 24 cumulative months of involuntary active duty during any six-month period since August 1, 2001, been involuntarily mobilized for 180 days or more within 6 months of a previous involuntary period of active duty of 100 days or more. Officials stress the program does not kick in automatically. Troops must apply for the income replacement by completing the new form, DD Form 2919, and submitting it to their servicing personnel office. So that's what they want them to do. So the effect is, when members of the National Guard or Reserves are called up to service in active duty, in addition to facing the prospect of death or maiming for life, many of us also suffer terrible financial hardship. Too many, unable to subsist on military pay, have been unable to make mortgage payments, have lost their homes, seen their children forced to drop out of colleges, universities, or other schools where they were enrolled, lacking tuition money, been unable to keep up payments for elderly parents and or other family members receiving full-time health care from nursing homes or other caregivers, and have been unable to make other customary and necessary payments that were possible on our civilians' income. This inflicts great suffering on members of our families and destroys our peace of mind and sense of security. It is intolerable that when we respond to the call to serve, we must not only face battle overseas, but witness ourselves and our family members driven into financial misery as we do so. Now, this petition has been signed by the National Guard, active duty, that have gone to Iraq, and we all know lately that we've been reading a lot about bankruptcy filings and debt of our military, especially the National Guard and Reserves. So, this is circulating. It's back on the table. If you know anybody in this situation, please make them aware of this. Thank you, and enjoy the rest of the program.
Okay. At this point, I have the honor of introducing to you a person who you've heard a lot about tonight, and that's Tom Barton, who's the editor of GI Special. And bears tremendous credit for the work that's being done on this issue of organizing and supporting organizing within the military against the war. Tom Barton. And Tom will introduce the next round of speakers, who I also think we're very honored to have here tonight.
Look, I'm the least important part of this program tonight. Brothers on my left are who have come here, have something certainly very urgent to say. There's a quote that came from Iraq where they served. They were sending articles into GI Special at that time. Someone had read one of their articles, and that person had said, more or less, they're writing a lot of stuff about the war. Well, if they were really moral people, and it was really a snotty letter, why don't they stand up and tell their commanding officer, I refuse to fight in this immoral war any longer. And if they don't do that, they're just dirt. This, of course, came from someone who was safely sitting here in the United States of America, risking nothing whatsoever. And they sent this answer back as part of a longer article. Before any soldier risks going to prison, he should realize that his ability to communicate with other troops will be limited. We choose our battles and continue to speak out in our underground action. There has to be a point when we reach a high enough number of troops in our peace effort that a unified boycott of all military action will have a desired effect. Let me repeat that. A unified boycott of all military action will have a desired effect. See, for them, it wasn't about them as individuals. For them, it was about organizing to stop war. It's a great honor to introduce to you tonight Jeff Engelhart, Garrett Reppenhagen, and Joe Hatcher, who organized against the war. There's no script here from now on for the next 30 minutes. I asked them simply to tell you something about what they did and how they felt about the importance of civilians to reach out to the troops. How you guys want to say this or go at it is entirely up to you. I'll just sit back and maybe ask a question or two, but basically keep my mouth shut.
Good evening. I'd like to thank everyone for coming out tonight. I think a pretty common attitude or feeling and sentiment that the American soldiers have right now in Iraq is that the public doesn't care. From all the faces here tonight, and I expect a lot less, I can tell right away that there is a lot of people that care. So I'd like to thank you all for coming out tonight. I prepared this little basic essay about how we felt while we were in Iraq, and I'll just start it off. Our war in Iraq had proven to be excruciating. We had to fight a war on two different fronts. One was against an insurgency that proved to be elusive and deadly. Another was against the army, as we stood openly opposed to the war and became vulnerable to harassment. Some people assume that the American soldiers are a faceless and mechanized fighting force, blindly following orders given to them by war hawks and profit gluttons in Washington, D.C. These soldiers are compared to stormtroopers, marching through obliterated towns in an ever-expanding empire, unfeeling, uncaring, their rifles aimed toward the horizon with patriotic fervor and the American flag behind them. U.S. soldiers are commonly viewed as the world police force, killing in the name of democracy. Most think that soldiers do not contemplate the ramifications of their jobs, nor is it their place to question the mission. They have the reputation of wholeheartedly supporting their commander-in-chief and never harboring anti-war sentiments. However, what is commonly missing from discussion is that soldiers are people, inherently capable of thinking individually, and they can easily come to despise warfare while engaged in its bloody practice. It wasn't after I joined the Army that I began to understand what the American soldier represents. Early in my enlistment, I came to despise the weak and callow men of authority, hiding behind their pretentious shields of rank and prestige. I realized that I was low in the chain of hierarchy and came to view the GI as a lowly proletariat, without a voice or a chance. Their system was enforced by draconian rules and idiotic regulations, and held together by conformity and fear. Individual thought was not encouraged. Orders were passed down from a higher echelon and obeyed unconditionally every step of the way. Military life, for me, was stale and rigid. I felt surrounded by herd mentality. To preserve a different state of mind, something I could center me, I began to educate myself on U.S. imperialism, along with our friends in our platoon. We shared a lot of literature that was considered radical, and it floated around endlessly. We saw U.S. imperialism in the history of hegemonic control over the world, and I saw the Army for what it was, a powerful militant arm of a corrupt and ruthless government. Literally the crack at the end of the whip. I was just another cog in the war machine, but I knew instinctively that in their world, knowledge was power. Soldiers have a very limited freedom of speech, one that hardly exists at all. The ironic aspect is that soldiers go to war to protect this freedom, which they can never have themselves. This type of hypocrisy catalyzed my desire to speak out against all hypocrisies Americans are faced with at home. It became a personal goal to return home and help the public to understand the truth based upon what I had experienced. I discovered that we were all tied in this war in one way or another. Every day, we pay the price to fight a war based on ideals that are against ourselves and others across the globe. When understanding this price, the conclusions are truly petrifying. We can try to omit the details of horror, or we can pursue this fight under the guise of false banners, but in the end, we will only destroy ourselves. Some argue that war is basic human attributes, and consequently, there will always be strife. I do not believe this to be true. Even in urban combat zones of Iraq, I saw people who are not my enemy, but people who believe in love and beauty and life like anyone else in the world. Human beings were never meant to wage war against each other. It was only the forces of corrupt power that persuade the masses to sacrifice their lives to jaded exaltations of God and empire. Modern man has certainly developed the intelligence and conscious capacity to find peaceful solutions to any problem, but only if that effort is made to the fullest. The responsibility to ensure peace and justice in the world lies with all of us. No longer should we trust in fraudulent politicians to lead us into prosperity, nor pass the liability on others for that future generations. No matter if we're veterans, activists, punks, peace freaks, tree huggers, commies, or conservatives, the walls of social differences must be removed and a broader task undertaken. This is our world, and by all means, we should fight to take it back.
You ain't heard nothing yet. What I'm going to ask these three brothers to do now is tell you a little about what it was like while in Iraq, organizing opposition to the war, what you could do, what you couldn't do, the risks you took, and the things that really happened there. Because that's going to give people an idea of what is possible and what people here can do to help people in the armed service reach out. And there's three mics here, so if each one of you take one, you can have a conversation among yourselves.
I'm Joe, and that's Garrett, and that's Jeff.
All right. I think what needs to also be understand about what's going on today in the military and what had happened in Vietnam was the culture, the peer pressure culture of the military lifestyle has changed dramatically. The environment in Iraq, the way the soldiers operate is very different. There's not a behind the lines. There's no Saigon. There's nowhere a soldier can go where he can put up his rifle and go out to a bar and have a drink. You shower with your weapon. You know, you sleep with your weapon. You know, you're in a small base usually, you know, a very limited area, where you're under constant scrutiny of your command, where it's so micromanaged that a lot of times, you know, you can't go to the bathroom without, you know, your sergeant knowing about it. So it's a very strange environment to try to launch any sort of resistance. The way we did it, it started off very naturally and I guess instinctively. There wasn't a popular movement. Iraq Veterans Against the War hadn't formed yet. You know, great documentaries like Sir No Sir haven't been put together yet, you know, so we didn't really know what we were going to do. We just knew we had to do something. We felt that in lieu of being there, stuck in the situation that we were in and doing the things we were doing and experiencing things we were doing, we had to be some sort of witness, at least to the American people. And I think that's where it started, was reaching out, writing letters to people we knew, and starting to organize that way. Obviously what comes before that is just the awareness that you gain to want to do that. And I think we were inspired by a lot of books that we read, a lot of the music that we were listening to, you know, and that sort of helped develop our ideas and just our general backgrounds, I suppose. But now there seems to be a growing movement within the United States, an environment here in America, which is going to help allow the soldiers to feel more comfortable to speak out and to act in a resistance. Now the majority of this nation is against the war and want the troops to come home. While we were there, it was less than 30% wanted the troops to withdraw from Iraq. Bush's approval rating was soaring. You know, we watched in dismay as he was reelected again. You know, It was crushing, and it was a constant struggle under this pressure and this danger of getting caught and receiving UCMJ punishment. The Uniform Code of Military Justice is unlike our legal system here in America. It It has an agenda. It has a mission.
And you're guilty until proven innocent, by the way.
You can't have a legal and fair judicial system if you have a mission that's entitled to it. And we realized right away that things weren't going to be fair to us if we were indeed caught and fully exposed. So we went about it with great caution. But I think the our ability to resist and speak out launched into a new perspective when we decided to start a blog.
The blog itself, our initial organization, our initial resistance didn't begin in Iraq. It began, you know, when the war began. We fought from the initial start. We started our resistance before the invasion ever happened. I mean, I was personally moved out of a line platoon and into a headquarters platoon because I was a negative influence on the soldiers around me because I made them think.
You have to keep in mind, too, that Joe Hatcher here was not in our unit, wasn't even in our brigade. He was always at least a two-hour drive away from us. Me and Garrett here were in the same unit, in the same platoon, so communication was probably key, definitely, throughout the whole time. And like you said, even before the war even started, it was a matter of talking through emails. So that's just what I wanted to...
Even while we were in Iraq, all three of us were eventually separated. And I never saw Joe Hatcher while I was in Iraq, even though we met in basic training and served together in Germany.
But we did see each other's tagging in the bathrooms.
That is true. That was one thing that was definitely recognizable was each other's shithouse taggings, I guess.
The website itself stemmed out of an idea I think Jeff found. There was a blogger, I believe his name was CBFTW, who was a guy who shared similar interests that we did. And he'd written a blog merely about his direct experiences, nothing positive, nothing negative. And he brought a lot of heat on himself. And we decided, well, if this guy's not taking any stand whatsoever and he's getting all this attention, we might as well step up our game. And so FTS Soldier was born. FTS, for those who aren't familiar, is fuck the system. But we churched it up a little bit, and we said it was fight to survive. And so FTS. And so ftssoldier.blogspot.com was born. The website was set up. The initial banner on it read, this website is the mouthpiece for a group of soldiers who are fighting for a president they didn't elect in a war they don't believe in, while the petrochemical complex turns the blood of their fallen comrades into oil.
It seems pretty extreme, definitely. We were just a bunch of punks before we joined the Army anyway, so it was just it's kind of fitting, but... yeah, it was. Our material was always seen as a little bit radical, and it still is to some degree. But that's fine. The way I see it, our founding fathers were radicals. I mean, how could they not be? So, a lot of people have asked me in like the last 18 months of how were you guys able to resist? How were you resistors? And it's kind of a complicated answer. I broke it down into three parts. First, we formed the idea of resistance, and then it came to direct action, and then the last one was not getting caught. That was important. We all had moral issues about staying in Iraq, of course.
Or going in the first place.
Or even going in the first place. But the sense of overwhelming power over your head when you're just a specialist in the Army is... It's a lot, and we kind of knew that we would lose out on a lot in our future lives and careers if we decided to bail out. We also kind of wanted to learn something deeper, a deeper knowledge about what it's like to fight in urban combat, and it certainly was an education that you can't buy in any college, so I don't think we regret going to Iraq now, but at the time it was pretty big dilemma. But if you want to touch upon, like, just some of the stuff we did as far as forming the idea of resistance.
Well, I think the moment that we heard that we were going to Iraq, we were still in Kosovo for a 9-month peacekeeping mission. where Joe was stuck in Germany still.
Yeah, I was supposed to be their replacement. They were set for a six-month block in Kosovo, and they ended up doing nine because my unit was the unit that was going to replace theirs. They pulled us from our Kosovo rotation so we could deploy to Turkey and be part of the initial attack from the north. As you remember, that didn't happen. The Turkish parliament denied that. And so I had to go and wait for the second tour, which means I was living out of a duffel bag with everything I owned in storage somewhere for almost a year. And that's just before we got off the ground.
I think when we finally got together, the question we were all asking ourselves wasn't, are we going to go to Iraq? We were asking each other, what are we going to do instead of going to Iraq? So I think we originally were under the impression that we just weren't going to go. We all had AWOL bags packed with civilian clothes so we could get off duty, change out of our uniform, and be out the door and gone like in 5 minutes and be in Amsterdam or Prague or wherever the hell we wanted to be. But faced with the situation, you know, our buddies were going. They weren't going to follow us. We still had the commitment. We still had friends and family at home. We wanted to return to America eventually. We thought that we wanted to be an American citizen and we wanted to come back and we wanted to eventually fight to change America to its deserved potential. So for some reason we decided to go along and go into war.
Morbid curiosity is the only way I can describe what finally got us there. We took a lot of long, hard trips through what our options were and what we could have done and how we could affect change, and we went anyway. And I think it's hard to build resistance in the military now. I mean, we're talking about activating active duty soldiers, but all of us enlisted before 9/11. And with the fervor that existed on 9/11, since then, you're not going to see the people that were on the left or the middle ground enlisting in the numbers they were. I mean, right now we're in a situation where everyone who was on the left, their four-year tour's up, they're out. And so we really do have just a bunch of stalwart clones reacting to orders in the enlisted end and on the officer's end. And most of the non-commissioned officers I worked with who were anti-war, I mean, they were in for life. They didn't care. They weren't preferential, they just did it anyway.
I think a lot of that's gonna change though. I think there's a lot of what used to be known as super patriots in the Army that were starting to come. I mean, I had an NCO, he was an E6 staff sergeant. He'd served 19 years in the Army and he had one more year until he was gonna retire, and he just had a kid that spring while he was in Iraq, and he got out of the Army that year and went to go be a forest ranger. So I applauded him on that, but I mean, there's a lot can be said about seeing the truth and just the insanity there. And I think despite the fact that a lot of the left side of the soldier or the left soldiers are no longer enlisting, I think they're gonna come home with a completely different attitude. I wanna, before we run out of time, touch up on what we consider direct action. It's not direct action, probably what the public kind of sees it as. We didn't sabotage any vehicles. We didn't hinder our troops any. We didn't hinder our fellow soldiers any. The mission went on as planned. It's just the idea of spreading this opinion about the war amongst other soldiers and how we did it. So I just want to get a touch up on that. Tom Barton here was an amazing, amazing hookup for us. He found us while we were writing, before we even had the website, he found us when we were just writing our essays and sending them in mass A to all the people we knew on our, you know, Yahoo account, basically. And I think he just found us somehow like that, and he got in touch with me, and he's like, you guys need some books to read. Of course we do. And he sent me a lot of stuff, Howard Zinn, Noam Chomsky, a lot of stuff, a lot of different old stuff too, old war resistor newspapers from Vietnam, books about resistance in the ranks during Vietnam, and that was a huge inspiration for me. And I like dreamt of the day. I was just like, yeah, you know, like this is what we need, and this is what we need in Iraq now. And although we couldn't get to that level, of course, it was definitely an inspiration. So he really hooked us up there. But he did send us a lot of radical newsletters and radical in our, you know, good patriotic sense of the word radical too. But stickers, and like we went on sticker campaigns where we just, they're little yellow, probably about that big, yellow stickers that say Bush lies, who dies. I think most people here have probably seen them.
We covered everything.
We went on sticker campaigns. They're so great to have in like any like urban punk will tell you, like, you slap a sticker on a wall real quick and you don't get caught doing it. And it was so nice to have that availability to say something so blatant and so true and put it like on an MWR TV set as you're walking
in,
by.
In the middle of the screen.
Anywhere perfect. We could stick these things. Anywhere. We noticed if we put them in highly visible places, they'd be immediately removed. And I never could get like the general consensus on what officers or non-commissioned officers thought of it. But if you hit them in convenient places where they wouldn't be seen, they'd last for days. And a lot of people would talk about them, like a lot of soldiers you could hear about talking about this Bush lies, who dies sticker on a corner of some stop sign on the fob. And they'd stay there for a long time. And the soldiers would just kind of keep it to themselves as like a big joke.
I mean, it's interesting because stickers are one thing. Graffiti was another thing. Writing was another thing. The graffiti, I mean, you go to Anaconda or something, which was closer to Jeff's base than mine, and, you know, you go into the bathroom there, and you look to your right, and there's a big swastika with a no over it that says, fight fascism, you know? I'm like, I know who put that there. And it's just, you know, the bathroom walls, he wrote a whole paper on it about how they're just an amazing medium for soldiers to intercommunicate with one another, and we took advantage of that. The stickers were another thing we took advantage of.
Free speech for soldiers in the bathrooms is probably, I mean, it's a private facility. There's no one's going to catch you riding it, and some of the conversations that would go on, and that's how I really started to see the amount of anti-Bush and anti-war feelings was in those port-a-johns. That's what we had in Iraq. That's all we really had for a long time. And just the amazing conversations that would take place. And there would be, I'd say the anti-war sentiment was much stronger than the pro, and much more intelligent too. People that were really supportive of Bush in the war were a lot more vulgar about what they said, and their points weren't made clear. And you could tell some smart soldiers are in the Army by what they would write on the walls with like markers and Sharpies. And this free speech for soldiers was just, that was our means of expressing ourselves without getting caught, and it was great.
Tom asked us, how did our officers feel about this? Well, at one point, a sergeant told me and Jeff that we were the worst thing that ever happened to the Army. after we actually, they started cracking down on the bloggers. They traced to the IP address some of our computers that we were blogging from, and they found out that I was particularly blogging. And we were about 2 months left in our year tour in Iraq when I got caught. And I ended up having to stand before the man twice, reporting to my lieutenant colonel, our battalion commander, knock on the door, you know, walking up, salute, you know, the whole bit. And you know, he told me to stop writing, which I didn't. And, you know, I continued to write. I had to, you know, they caught me again. I had to report again, you know, and he told me, Rep, you know, you're a great soldier. The day before, I just received my good conduct medal for not getting in trouble the entire time I was in the military. The very next day, I'm getting punished. And he says, Rep, you're a good soldier. You're just a bad person. So there's certainly there's some commanders, I think, that that supported what we were doing but couldn't openly support it.
I know for a fact that my executive officer was supportive, not publicly or, you know, even vocally by any means, but between comments, because he got a hold of something that Garrett had written through a forwarded email somehow. And he mentioned it to me, and I said, yeah, it's up on the website. And he didn't mention it since, and I got a message from him 3 days ago on the IVAW's website saying, nice beard. So, I guess he's pretty supportive.
Joe, aren't you the author, and I assume your commander never saw it, of the headline article in GI Special, We Need a Motherfucking Revolution?
Was that me?
I think that was
Did
you,
I do
Joe.
That?
Yeah, it was Joe.
I don't even remember.
I don't remember the content.
The time
of it,
fog is thick when it comes to Iraq, man. It's a lot of tan memories that all kind of blend together.
A lot of things I want everybody to understand, though, is when a soldier joins the military, he enters a contract, not only a written contract, but also a social contract to his country. He gives an oath to his country that if their country needs it, if we need defense or stop an injustice in the world, that it's him who's giving the oath to the American people that he'll go and do it. And, you know, that's a huge responsibility, and that's a sacrifice, and that's what service is. But you must understand that, you know, when that contract is broken to the soldier first, when he's not used responsibly as a last resort option, you know, when all other peaceful solutions are exhausted to a conflict, you know, when he's thrown into a war without proper planning, without proper training, without proper equipment, you know, for causes that have proved fraudulent, you know, that contract is broken to the soldier first. And, you know, in my opinion, he has every right to resist and, you know, and stop.
Above all else, the first thing a soldier does is swear to uphold the Constitution of the United States. Now, the Constitution unto itself is it's a slightly foul document. We have little things in there about women and blacks and others that weren't quite equal enough when we wrote it the first time, but, you know, we're getting there. And the Constitution itself is what we need to be protecting and defending, not our country's financial interests abroad. We need to be taking care of ourselves. If we're spending $600 billion in Iraq in a year and we can't take care of Katrina, if this is about homeland security, how is this going on? Soldiers have a right to refuse, resist, go AWOL. I mean, they're being given unlawful orders. The big dub himself said it will be no excuse to say you were just following orders. And I mean, it's soldiers can walk. Their contract has been broken and nullified, you know? I wish I'd have known that.
And also, this isn't a volunteer army anymore. As it was discussed earlier, you know, I served 10 months involuntarily, you know, under a stop loss. You know, I'm still in the individual ready reserve and I can be called back at any time. You know, soldiers are going to multiple deployments. 25% of the soldiers in Iraq are there for the first time. 50% are on their second tour, and the last 25% are on 3 tours or more. The National Guard are being called up again, you know, and they weren't designed to be used in this manner. You know, it's you know, the waivers for recruitment are skyrocketing. The budget for recruitment is skyrocketing. You know, it's an economic draft where the underprivileged who gain the least from this democracy are sacrificing the most.
I mean, I was in Olympia months ago. What
do you stop talking about chicken?
I was in Olympia a couple months ago and there was a big news story there because recruiters had enlisted and were preparing to send to basic training a kid who was probably 17 with Down syndrome, and they just took him. He could sign the paper. That was good enough for them. And I mean, I served with some people I were pretty sure were retarded, and now I have proof. It's just... it's amazing what recruiters will stoop to. It's amazing who recruiters will take. It's amazing how they will rape a community for its poorest people. This last Simpsons episode just tore military recruiters apart. I mean, they did everything from, you know, lie, cheat, steal, say they were gay. What else went on? They, I don't know.
It was a good bit.
A good bit.
Social parodies like you see on, like, sitcoms now, I mean, it's getting, if you watch Family Guy or Simpsons, I don't watch much of it, but when I do see these episodes that are just so blatantly making fun of this administration or the war effort, I mean, that's good. I mean, I totally agree with social parody like that, but it's becoming so obvious that this whole thing was just fraudulent from the very start. And a good film that anyone that's not aware of this, a good film to see is Iraq for Sale. It really just lays out on the line exactly what kind of war profiteering was going on.
We went into that country attempting to steal
everything, every natural resource. We went in there and we nullified the patents they held and stole every patent that country had. We went for a full takeover in every single way. We say we're not setting up permanent bases, but we're building an embassy there, which is one single structure larger than Vatican City. 108 acres.
And it's hard to stop. I mean, even one example of some direct action that I did while I was in Iraq, we had soda and ice cream in our cafeteria that the soldiers were allowed to have. But to bring that soda and ice cream to our base, we needed to escort convoys of Halliburton refrigerated trucks to bring them to us, right? So soldiers were risking their lives so they could eat ice cream and drink soda. So I started a direct action campaign where during lunch after I ate, I would stand up in front of the soda and ice cream with a sign saying, you know, don't eat ice cream, you're killing soldiers, you know? And that lasted about 3 days, you know, before I was told to take that down.
It's just amazing that the majority of the missions you see run in Iraq is soldiers escorting Halliburton trucks so Halliburton can come in, improve the base, bring in more soldiers so you can escort more Halliburton trucks. That's basically what goes on nonstop there. I mean, that's the only thing I did. That's the only thing I saw.
I got a question for Garrett. Garrett, we can't come to the end of this first part. And by the way, all the speakers are coming back for a summary after you have a chance to say some things. I can't let it go without you letting the people in on how you would sneak people into your living quarters and show them those subversive DVDs and organize that little group there. You want to say a word about that? Because it's important people understand what's possible.
Well, I definitely had a little sanctuary in Iraq. My hooch was definitely filled with plenty of subversive material. And, you know, I'd talk to guys and eventually, you know, just invite them over and throw in an old copy of Fuck the Army, which was, you know, a documentary about, you know, the traveling USO show, USO type show that went around in Vietnam, and people watched that. And it was eye-opening, but it was slow. You know, I wouldn't stand on a soapbox and say, you know, I hate this war, you know, come with me. It took time, you know, and I talked to soldiers while I was in the guard shack, and, you know, I just explained to them, you know, hey, you know, do you hear about that farmer that we popped in the field the other day? He's like, yeah, man, that guy really got it. You know, he was just out there farming. And he's like, yeah, I know. What do you think about that? Well, I don't know. I guess it's better, you know, him than me. And I say, well, what'd your dad do for a living? He's a farmer, you know? It's like, oh, you know, well, that guy could have been just like your dad, you know? And you just start talking to him like that and start making him realize that, you know, they're not out there just pulling triggers, you know? There's consequences and, you know, there's deeper underlying messages, and they start clearing their heads a little bit, and they come to that one all-important question that every soldier should eventually ask: why? You know, and that's the killer.
It was so much more effective to keep your head down and keep going at it from underneath, you know, in the Army, underneath the Army's blanket and underneath their radar. I mean, it was so obvious that the Army does profile for undesirables, and thought crime is a real thing. So to come out, like, I know some on the extreme left here in America were probably saying, why don't they resist the war? Why don't they stand up and go, you know, go to jail and risk that to stand up for their beliefs? Well, I honestly think that if we had more subverts in the Army, things would be going a lot smoother. There's no sense in sticking your neck out and you having your head knocked off for it. And our thing was just don't get caught. Just don't get caught doing it. Cover your tracks and know who you're talking to. Know you trust them. And if, like he was talking about the kid in the guard tower, play devil's advocate to his good conscience, you know. That was a lot more effective. And just little tiny forms of direct action go a long way. As I remember when you were, you found out from an Iraqi how to write fuck Bush in Arabic. And we were, a lot of people, a lot of the soldiers, it was kind of common practice to have signs on the back of your Humvee, if it's written in Arabic, to stay back 50 meters so you wouldn't get get shot if you were an Iraqi. Well, so they wouldn't even notice. Like, the Army had no idea that we were writing fuck Bush on all the trucks.
They assume that it They assumed that it said, you know, stop or I'll shoot or something like that, but not so much.
Iraqis are honking at us and woo, you know. And that helps. That helps to extend relations. I hope if one thing the Iraqis understood, it was that a lot of soldiers don't want to be there. And I mean, I know it's not a good excuse, but you know, when you're put in that kind of situation for that many years, you can't just stick your head out and get it knocked off. And like extending relations is important. Having the Iraqis know that we were opposed to it, I think, might have helped a lot of Iraqis deal with our occupying forces there. So, just tiny little examples of direct action and not playing the martyr, because I've never seen one martyr in history go out gracefully. It's always been pretty brutal. So,
when I want to talk about a little bit about how everyone here can help. And I see all these stickers around towns in America that say support the troops, and you know, it's like Rage Against the Machine says, you know, they look like swastikas to me, you know, but the question I don't understand is, why don't they say support our troops? You know, there's a disconnect now between civilians and our military where we no longer take ownership for them. You know, I signed up to be a weapon in my democracy, and I assumed that I was going to represent the majority's want and will. And right now, it seems like most people see a man in uniform and they think, well, there's one of Bush's soldiers. You know, but it's not the case. You know, those soldiers are our soldiers. And when you see them in, you know, in the airport in uniform, think, there's one of my soldiers. And what am I going to do with my soldier? Because in the end of the day, they're just the bullets. You know, it's our citizenry that is pulling the trigger. And, you know, it's up to us to build that relationship with our soldiers again, so they understand that, you know, we and them are one, you know, and it's all part of the system, and that we're not a tool of the administration, but we're a tool of our society.
Now,